am Ender Black, and you've probably heard me or heard about me from my awesome top-rated show, Squirrel Snow, every fourth Friday of the month. And I want to comment on something really cool that happened to me, and it is that I was granted something called, let me see if I say it right, the Marla Davis Fund for Native American Programming. And it's what they call a mini grant, just, you know, a little money, but good money, so that I will be able to use to create content, you know, to get equipment that, to be quite honest, I wouldn't be able to get because it's outside what they call budget. So it's been a really awesome experience. I mean, I knew that I was eligible for the grant for a long time.
The preceding program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at KBOO.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited series coming to our airwaves and your favorite podcast platform. It's called Running on Air, a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. Every weekday, your favorite KBOO host will be facilitating a deeper conversation with these candidates, so tune in. Find the full schedule on our website, kboo.fm/runningonair. Listen to any episodes of Running on Air that you miss on the KBOO website or wherever you get your podcasts. That's kboo.fm/runningonair.
If you stop to listen, hear their hearts beating loud. Can't keep those California Indians down.
Hello everyone, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. From Marcus Lopez, I'm your host, Larry Smith. On today's program, Indigenous Nations in Southeast Alaska request a formal intervention by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to stop the violent colonial legacy of mining throughout the region that endangers life, Indigenous nations, and more. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves.
You can hear when the moon shines bright, the lone fool in the black of the night. You can hear the whisper in the valley. And you know when Kamakani blows to the Bahu drum, it's the warriors who are marching.
Today on American Indian Airwaves, we go to Southeast Alaska and British Columbia, or BC Canada, to discuss the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission, the SEITC, which consists of 15 Indigenous nations in the Southeast Alaska and rooted along Canada's transboundary rivers, recent submission of a formal request with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, a legal organization that is part of the Organization of American States, to halt the reckless mining activity that is violating Indigenous peoples' human rights. Dozens of mining companies are seeking permission from the government of British Columbia to develop some of the world's largest gold mines in the headwaters of Southeast Alaska's transboundary rivers, and the Canadian government continues denying the sovereign rights of the Alaska Native Nations living downstream from various extractive mining activities. In fact, a recent decision ordered by Canada's Ministry of Land, Water and Resource Stewardship on June 27th of 2024 could guarantee destruction of both a critical ecological hotspot and the ways of life of the Southeast Alaska Nations. Skeena Resources Limited in 2021 proposed a major gold and silver mining project called the Eskay Creek Project. It is one of eight mines in British Columbia, or BC, that are at issue. But the Eskay Project, which is in the final environmental review state, and if built, would produce an estimated 7.5 million tons of gold and silver over an estimated 14-year mine lifespan. The Eskay Creek Project would be in the same area as a previous mine that operated from 1994 to 2008. The Eskay Creek Project risks Southern Alaska Native Nations rivers, including the Onuk, the Stikeen, and the Taku, five species of wild Pacific salmon, and more, with possible extinction. Our guest for the hour to discuss the crisis is Guy Archibald, Executive Director of the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission, and Esther Reese, who's President of the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission and serves as the Tribal Administrator for the Wrangell Cooperative Association, the federally recognized nation in Wrangell and located at the mouth of the Stikeen River. We begin today's interview with Esther Reese introducing us to what is the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission, and now the interview.
A little bit of background first on SEITC. We are a consortium of 15 tribes that have come together to try to protect our lands and waterways. SEITC is this consortium is meant to help us get a seat at the table so that we can continue to steward our lands, since our ancestors have done since time immemorial. We basically, a lot of the tribes that are a part of SEITC live at the mouths of wonderful, huge rivers that have sustained our people with all species of salmon and traditional subsistence foods. And what we are dealing with today is we are no longer able to help steward our lands because of what we consider a colonial border. We consider the border between Canada and Alaska to be a colonial construct. It was never in existence in our ancestors' time, and they were able to go back and forth and steward the lands and live off of these lands. And now, because of that colonial border, that right has been taken away from us as tribal citizens. And so what we're trying to do with this most recent request is get a seat at the table for the tribes that are impacted, and also create and set a precedent for tribes that live in other areas in Southeast Alaska. I would say the urgency relates to the fact that, I'll just give you an example, on the Stikeen River, which is where I live. So I'm just north of the Unuk River watershed in Wrangell, and currently operational on the Stikeen is the Red Chris Mine. The Red Chris Mine was built by Imperial Metals, which is the same company that built Mount Polley, except the Red Chris Mine is bigger. It is the earthen tailings dam is 344 feet high, and it holds 110 billion cubic feet of toxic mining waste. And so it's just a matter of time before there is some kind of catastrophic failure. And I will tell you what I have heard and learned through visiting BC and other areas where they've had mining failures and mining leaching. So I was in BC for a conference and met some people, and they just related how their children will never be able to practice our traditional subsistence ways. They will never be able to catch salmon. They will never be able to smoke salmon. The salmon are too compromised, and or even do not exist in those waterways. And so I'm just imagining that heartbreak and what that will be like for my children to never have that experience, because for me, salmon and our foods are another connection to our ancestors and a connection to our way of life that's so precious to us. And I think Guy was mentioning when he was here in Wrangell about how there was a tribal citizen who basically stated that for their area, because of mining and other development, that the salmon only exist in their myths. And it's only a matter of time before we in Southeast Alaska, with transboundary mining issues, are in the same situation. And I don't want my children, I don't want my grandchildren to have to say that salmon only exists in our myths.
Guy, would you like to add?
Speaking to the urgency, the area, the headwaters of these rivers to the First Nations is known as the sacred headwaters because of their life-giving to the people of the land. But to the BC mining companies, it's called the Golden Triangle. And it is mining development that otherwise is uneconomical is now being powered by the Northwest Transmission Line that is powering all these mines. And there are many. There's the Red Chris and the Bruce Jack that are already up and operating. And there are two that are fully permitted, the KSM on the Unic River and the Gore Creek on the Stikine, that they're fully permitted. And if and when they're built, they will be among the top five largest open pit mines ever built in the world. The KSM in the Unic River is supposed to treat and release 192,000 gallons of contaminated water a minute for 252 years, and releasing it into the Unic River, which is fully one-third of the flow of the Unic River. There's many explorations and advanced exploration. There are several that are going through the permitting process. BC considers their Northwest Territory as a sacrifice zone for their economic benefit. But the Alaska tribes are downstream of all of this, and we have not been consulted in any way, shape, or form on any of these mines. And so we went ahead and lacking any other recourse, we've filed a formal complaint with the Inter-American Commission.
And what I'm hearing from you, and actually from both of you, is there's been no free prior informed consent to any indigenous nation whatsoever. And so maybe follow up with that. Is that true in my understanding? And then also, when did this process start? I mean, how many opportunities have these mining companies, was it like Skeena and others, have they had to actually consult with Alaska Indigenous peoples?
There has been no consultation with the tribes, and the Unic watershed was one that we were hoping would be the first. And Guy did amazing work with Sea Alaska Heritage Foundation to put together maps showing that area was Wertok Lady clan territories, and that our current tribes here were modern day successors of that clan. And so this was our first attempt, because there has not been any consultation, and this was our first. Guy can give you sort of the history of what the mines had, what kind of consultation or anything that had occurred between the mines, as far as this was supposed to be our first.
Guy?
Yeah, the KSM mine began their environmental assessment in about 2008. And at that time, individually, tribes expressed their concern. But that was all we were able to do, was just say, hey, we have concerns about, this mine and its process moving forward. Please come talk to us. They never did. And the Red Chris mine became operational within months of the Mount Pawley disaster. And the dam was built by the same company, the same contractor even, that built the failed Mount Pawley dam, which was a brand new state-of-the-art tailings dam, less than 20 years old, that catastrophically failed 10 years ago, a couple weeks ago. And throughout all of these mines, the tribes attempted to engage and were just basically ignored. And that's why in 2015, they got together and decided to kind of pool their resources and pool their voice by forming this commission to deal with it. In the meantime, BC signed a memo of understanding with the state of Alaska to share information. The tribes were not a party to this agreement. They were not signatures on this agreement. And they've been even left out of that process between the state of Alaska and BC. And so BC, they call it engagement. They will engage with us. They'll show us the public notices. They'll show us the information, you know, on the mines and this and that. But there is no duty for deep consultation. We applied for what is called participating Indigenous Nation status in BC. So basically that our rights that are protected under the Canadian Constitution, Section 35, would be recognized. The Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people, the nations, are recognized in Canada and British Columbia. But the same Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people west of that colonial border somehow don't have any rights, you know, on the same rivers, the same people on the same rivers. And it's just astounding that British Columbia makes, they call it a distinctions-based approach. Some people get rights, other people don't have rights. And we point out that that was the same attitude that fueled forced assimilation and removal of lands in the boarding school history that Canada is trying very hard to, quote, reconcile these days. But it's the very same kind of philosophy that certain people are granted a certain level of human rights and others not so much.
Yeah, we want to remind listeners you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Guy Archibald, Executive Director, and Esther Reese, President of the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission, which consists of 15 Indigenous nations in Southeast Alaska and rooted along Canada's transboundary rivers. The commission recently filed a formal and urgent request with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, calling for the stop of the reckless mining activity that is violating Indigenous people's human rights throughout the region and places them at risk and all life forms for extinction. And now back to the interview here on American Indian Airwaves. Esther, it's real clear there's been no free prior informed consent in consultation with Southeastern Alaska nations by these mining companies that operate in British Columbia or BC, Canada, if you will. And earlier you were talking about the real possibilities of future generations of Alaska Native people being unable to live in accordance to their original instructions, right? In accordance with their traditional practices because of the settler colonial violent legacy of the extractive mining industry. And there's another mine that's waiting a final approval that would be an open pit gold and silver mine along with extracting other base metals as well. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the settler colonial violence of mining, because it's just not Indigenous peoples that are impacted. It's salmon and other plant and animal relations.
Yes, thank you for asking that question, Larry. So I would love to talk about the history of our people and how we've cared for the lands and the evidences of that, and then how that feels to be fighting this fight for our lands. So here in Wrangell in Southeast Alaska, in an area called our back channel, there was a cave, and a dog bone was located in this cave, an animal bone. And it was dated at 10,000 years old, and it was a domesticated dog bone. So it's one of the oldest domesticated dog bones found in North America, and that was 10,000 years ago. Our people utilized systems for fishing called fish traps, and there are these long wooden stakes that you pound into the beach, and you create this pathway for the salmon to swim up these fish traps. And then when the tide goes out, the salmon are trapped, and it was a form of fishing. And those fish traps are still evident around Wrangell Island, and it's so amazing to see them, Larry. You can see some that have fallen out of the beach, and you look at these, they have points to them, and you can see where my people had carved these into points to drive into the beach, and you can see those marks that are 1,500 and 2,000 years old.
Wow.
We went recently to one of the town sites near Wrangell, and we there had the opportunity to probe for shell midden. And shell midden was basically our ancestors' garbage. It was the shells from the foods, the fish bones, things of that sort. And so we use these long probes where you can see there's one open side of the probe, and you can see the different layers of soil. And when you probe for the shell midden and you pull it out, you can see the different layers, and there's like a purple layer of shell midden. And it's just amazing to do this because the shell midden is dated to be about 2,000 years old as well. And when you rub that shell midden between your fingers, you can still feel the oils of our foods on your fingers. It is the most amazing thing to go out on our land and see these very old evidences of our ancestors and to feel that connection and to wonder, you know, what they were like, and to just walk on that same land that they walked on. And so there is scientific proof to back up our oral traditions that we have been on this land since time immemorial. And to the south of Wrangell is the location of where the actual old town site of the people of the Stikine Kwan, which are the people of Wrangell. So the people of the Stikine Kwan lived to the south in Wrangell, and there was a place there called Old Town where they lived, and you can still see 50 to 60 canoe rests where they would pull their canoes up and their long lines of rocks. And if you ever get a chance to come visit, Larry, it is the vibrations of the earth there are just so beautiful and powerful, and it just feels different. And I went out there with a professor, the foremost linguist of our language, the Tlingit language, and I just said, it just feels so different here. And he said, that is because the land here was well-loved. And what we are having to do now is continue that love of our ancestors and continue to care for our lands. And it's very traumatic. It's a very traumatic experience to have thought about our ancestors, think about the smallpox that ran through our people, and 95 to 96% of our population was lost. And then the forced assimilation and the colonization and the absolute trauma of having our children shipped off to boarding schools and the forced loss of our languages and the forced loss of our potlatches when our potlatches were banned and we weren't able to practice our culture. Our totems tell our stories. We don't have a written language, and our totems are our storybooks. And our totems were chopped down and they were burned. And so now, and side note on the totems, we do have the first totem project in Wrangell in 37 years.
Wow.
And we have a master carver who is teaching our apprentices, because we currently have no master carvers in Wrangell, and we're involving the school children. And so my goal when we have this totem raising is to be able to have those school children read that totem, have them read our book, our Tlingit book. And so that's my goal with that. But it's very traumatic to have that history, to the racism that our people encountered. In my grandfather's day, there was segregation. There were the Tlingits on one side of the movie theater and the wipes on the other. There were different drinking fountains. He would see signs on the restaurants that said no dogs, no Indians. And that trauma working its way through our generations and everything we're trying to do to heal that trauma, and then to have to fight these extractive industries to protect our lands that our ancestors had protected, and to have to fight this is an additional level of trauma for us, and it's one that we just can't bear to lose. I don't want my grandchildren and great grandchildren to have to say the salmon only exists now in our myths. And I will do everything in my power. I will stand on the shoulders of my ancestors to try to prevent that. And that is why I am so grateful for all the work SEITC is doing on this for us, and everything Guy is doing, and all the people who have come forward to assist, because these are our lands, these are our waterways, these are places that have been well loved, and we can't lose this fight.
A question for the both of you. You know, we've been talking about the history of the land for southeastern Alaska nations that are along these transboundary rivers right between the settler colonial borders of the Alaska and the United States side and British Columbia and Canada. But, you know, when we talk about the legacy of the mining industry, what about other settler colonial violent events, if you will? So I'm thinking of the recent approval by FEMA for monies to clean up the hazardous waste on the beach up there. So, you know, what about the compounded effects of settler colonial violence and other events that have happened that aggravate and threaten with greater intensification, if you will, indigenous peoples' traditional life ways and life forms throughout the region? And Esther, we'll start with you, followed up by Guy.
Yeah, I think it definitely is being compounded specific to Eskay Creek on the Unic River. I do know that the Takwe D from that area talk about how when those mines were running, the hooligans stopped running, and they're just now starting to come back, and there's just much concern about reopening those mines, just as Mother Earth is trying to heal herself. And yeah, related to FEMA, Wrangell Cooperative Association, I'm the tribal administrator of the Wrangell tribe, and I'm honored to serve in that capacity as well as the president of SEITC, and we were the first tribe in the state of Alaska to get a FEMA presidential disaster declaration for our landslide, and that was also an attempt to clean up the beach, because below the high tide water line, the entire landslide, it was not cleaned up. And so we were very concerned about that area because of leaching of hazardous materials. It is a beach that's a traditional subsistence area. In fact, prior to the landslide, our Earth Branch Department had completely mapped out that beach with clams and cockles. Mm-hmm. There is shell midden in that area, so evidence that our people had stewarded that and utilized that land since time immemorial. And ironically enough, is that beach is also at the mouth of the output of Pat's Lake here, which in 2017, our tribe had to fight the state of Alaska because they wanted to build a lead-contaminated monofill 0.2 miles from an anadromous stream, which flowed into Pat's Lake, which flowed into the very beach in question. And so we did win that fight with the state of Alaska, but now with our landslide and our beach, we are now in the very same area, ironically enough, having to fight and work to have that beach cleanup occur. And so, yes, I feel like in the capacity of being the tribal administrator here in Wrangell and also with SEITC, it feels like one fight after another on lands that used to belong to us, and they're lands that we no longer have any say over, and we want to continue that stewardship.
Guy, would you like to add?
You know, we've seen, especially in the history of Canadian mining companies, once these extractive industries have rationalized violence against Mother Earth, you know, for no other reason but to extract gold, you know, which is pure vanity and greed, you know, mineral. You know, once they have taken that philosophical step that it's okay to commit that violence to Mother Earth, and we've seen this over and over, then it's actually a very small step to rationalize actual violence against women and children and Indigenous people. And it's not just, you know, as we see with missing and murdered Indigenous women, you know, all over the state and region, but the very fact that these rivers are still as productive and resilient as they are is because of the tens of thousands of years of stewardship done by the Indigenous people of this region. And that when we talk about salmon, it's not just about feeding our bellies. The salmon are integral to the entire forest. This is a rainforest. It can rain 300 inches a year, and the rain tends to leach out all of the nutrients in the soil. And every spring, in the spring freshet, all the nutrients get washed out in the ocean, but also washed out is millions and millions of little salmon fry. And they go out into the ocean, and they reabsorb all those nutrients. And 3, 5, 7 years later, depending on the species, they come back to those freshwater habitats, and they bring all that nutrients back to the forest, and they feed the forest. We can actually find scientifically salmon-derived nitrogen and phosphorus in the trees, in the bushes, in the bears, in the eagles. They call it salmon in the trees. So if we destroy this freshwater habitat through mine contamination, you know, not only are we destroying, you know, cultures that have gone on for tens of thousands of years through periods of climate change and migration over glaciers and under glaciers, but we're actually going to destroy this entire forest in Southeast Alaska. And it's of global significance because the what's called now the Tongass National Forest, it contains 40% of all of the carbon sequestration, I'm probably not saying that right, ability of all of the nation's national forests combined. And to threaten that with just greed and vanity type mineral that all that gold represents, to me is just unconscionable. It's just that short term profit taking extractive industry mindset.
Yeah, we want to remind listeners you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Guy Archibald, Executive Director, and Esther East, President of the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission, which consists of 15 Indigenous nations in Southeast Alaska and rooted along Canada's transboundary rivers. The commission recently filed a formal and urgent request with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, calling for the stop of the reckless mining activity that is violating Indigenous people's human rights throughout the region and places them at risk and all life forms for extinction. In defending the sacred and in talking about what you brought up, Guy, what most people know is a climate crisis, which for Indigenous peoples and their respective First Nations, this is the current generation of the climate crisis, if you will. If we look at the colonial legacy of scorched earth policies of ripping the veins out of Mother Earth, if you will, over the generations. But, you know, in talking about what people understand as climate crisis, what other aspects of the climate crisis, if you will, elevate this sense of urgency? So are the waters warming? Is there less glaciers, less snow that, you know, destabilizes the topsoil throughout the regions that increases the runoff, where, you know, more mining would just exacerbate the contamination levels, if you will, and adversely, you know, kill off more life. And so are there additional factors to take into consideration about the urgency of stopping this mining project?
Yes, I absolutely agree with that. With the current climate crisis, our glaciers are receding. If you look at pictures of our glaciers, even 5 or 10 years ago, there is a lot of difference, and it can be quite shocking. The waters are definitely warming. We're having less snow. Our landslide here in Wrangell, which was a huge blow to our community, we lost a whole family to the landslide, and another individual, and they were all just really integral parts of our community. We are a small community of 2,000, and that was during a period of extremely heavy rainfall, unusually heavy rainfall, that destabilized the side of a mountain and brought that crashing down to the beach. And the changes in weather patterns definitely are impactful for all sorts of parts of our like all sorts of aspects of our environment, to include mining contamination. And so it's just this perfect storm. And our, like Guy had said, the Tongass National Forest is our home, but it's also important to the entire country for how it cares for us. And to add this additional burden with everything else is just making this perfect storm of an emergency and something that we might not recover from.
Guy?
Yes, I agree completely with Esther. I don't think it's realized that right now the climate is changing at a faster rate than any time in the Earth's entire history. Right. Second only to the day the asteroid struck the planet and destroyed the dinosaurs. We're seeing die-offs of king salmon, Chinook salmon, or as they called in Canada, the spring salmon. And they're kind of an indicator species because their eggs are larger than any other salmon eggs. And so there's less surface area, and they need a lot more dissolved oxygen in the water. But as our fresh water heats up, it's less able to hold dissolved oxygen. And we're basically witnessing an extinction of a species right before our eyes here. The king salmon are suffering a lot. I know when I lived down in Wrangell, catching a 50-pound king salmon was nothing. That was, oh, okay, got a fish. Nowadays, like here in Juneau, we just had the salmon derby last weekend. I believe the winner of the derby was a 26-pound fish. And they're just, not only has their size diminished, but their abundance has dropped way off. And it's due to a variety of factors, climate change and, you know, destruction of the freshwater habitat. Juneau here in Occoquan territory just 2 weeks ago suffered a glacial outburst flood. And these glacial outburst floods happen every summer now. They just started like 10, 11 years ago due to climate change. And this year's glacial outburst flood flooded almost 300 houses out in the valley.
Wow.
And displaced, you know, 300 families. And it's going to happen every year now, you know, year after year. Our rain regime has completely changed. We used to get kind of a constant drizzle rain, you know, that may go on for months at a time. Now we get these violent downpours. I think last year in Ketchikan, they had over 7 inches of rain in a single hour. And these bursts of water coming down the rivers, they scour out the cobble, they scour out the eggs, you know, the salmon eggs in the gravels. They re-channelize the rivers. They make the channels deeper. So our coho salmon or the silver salmon, they breed in these little side channels, you know, off the river. But after a big flood event like that, it channels the river where they can no longer access these side channels. And so we're seeing, you know, harms being done to coho. And it's you know, it's right before our eyes. But the one thing I think is the indigenous people understand that change has always happened. And again, in their oral history, there's stories of migrating and coming and going, and glaciers coming and going, you know, living on the land and having a constant presence on the land so long that you've observed glaciers come and go. And they migrated into the inland. A lot of these river valleys, like the Yunuk River, was considered a place of refuge, you know, during the last ice age, and then the great flood that followed the ice age. And so we have in our current oral history, you know, stories and lessons of, you know, an adaptation to climate change. And that needs to be, those lessons and the traditional land management systems, you know, they need to be reinstated here, and they need to be done, you know, this needs to be done quickly, because we can't wait, or we're gonna lose this system that has sustained people here for since time immemorial.
Esther, I'm not sure if you wanted to add to that. I know in other indigenous nations up in, you know, the Arctic, you know, and there are certain cultural bearers that have that knowledge of reading, you know, the glaciers and those relational ways. And so with the going, if you will, of glaciers and their changes, I would imagine that has additional negative impacts, and along with everything else that we've been discussing. Is that fair to say?
It's definitely fair to say. And I think that, you know, in our culture, we're all about balance, and we're all about respect. And I think if you just take those simple aspects, not simple, actually, powerful aspects of our culture, and you apply them in meaningful ways, I think our culture has the potential to illuminate the world. And I think looking at the way we have our society set up with our youth learning from our elders, and our elders passing down that knowledge, and the culture bearers that you speak of, they need to be consulted. They need to be able to tell what the lands looked like when they were young, and they should be revered and honored as the caretakers of this land, instead of being ignored, and instead of these fights that we're having to fight currently regarding mining and beach cleanups and monofills and water quality standards for the state of Alaska, all these different things that we're fighting. It should be completely opposite. They should be asking how the land was cared for.
With the work that SEITC has been doing over the years and showing how harmful, right, the extractive mining industry is, say, for gold and silver and other base metals, such as the case if the Eskay Creek project is finalized for approval. But you've collected a lot of data that really shows, you know, indigenous peoples and non-indigenous peoples are also adversely affected across these colonial borders of just not only the United States and British Columbia and Canada, but also in the lower 48 up in the Northwest region. I was wondering, for our listeners, could you talk more about that and how this further shows the violence and the need to stop the legacy of the mining industry throughout the area?
You know, we've worked pretty close with the Upper Columbia River United Tribes.
Right.
And so, you know, we've seen a lot of data, you know, from the Teck Cominco coal mines coming over, you know, primarily selenium contamination. And, you know, BC has fairly strict limits. They're actually stricter than Alaska limits on selenium, but there's no enforcement of it. And selenium levels are coming across the border at 60 times the aquatic life criteria. And it's been very harmful to the Upper Columbia River tribes, who have spent millions of dollars, you know, restoring, you know, bull trout in their systems, which are similar to our Dolly Vardens. And it's you know, been incredibly destructive and just heartbreaking to see their efforts just go to waste because of this contamination. And now luckily the International Joint Commission, you know, got a referral finally from both Canada and the United States to start to study this situation. But selenium is also considered the most dangerous potential contaminant of the KSM mine. And the KSM people, Seabridge Gold, says, oh, well, we'll treat it. We'll be able to treat it. And in fact, their BC environmental certificate allows them to begin mining under the agreement that they figure out a way to treat the selenium within the first 5 years. Well, Teck Cominco above the Elk River and the Kootenai River has spent billions of dollars trying to figure out and failed to find a reliable system to remove selenium. And so there is no current technology to do that. And yet these mines continue to move forward. Here in Alaska, just upstream from Juneau here on the Taku River is the Tulsiklaachi mine. A very small underground mine, and it was abandoned. You know, the companies went through bankruptcy several times. It has been leaking acid mine drainage into the Taku River now for 65 years. Wow. Without any real attempts by British Columbia or the responsible parties to clean this thing up. You know, despite, you know, even us, we'll use that as our poster child for bad mining practices by British Columbia. It's a black eye to the Environmental Assessment Agency in British Columbia, and yet nothing ever seems to be done about it. And this mine is tiny. It's probably, you know, a 50th the size of a KSM. But here it is, it's still, you know, 65 years later, leaking acid mine drainage and a, you know, whole alphabet soup of dissolved metals, you know, into the Taku River, directly above Juneau.
Esther, did you want to add to that? Or?
Yeah, so I actually didn't want to add to that so much as just add another point to the conversation, and that is the fact that precedence has already been set with British Columbia and Canada. And I wanted to mention the Deschutes case, where Mr. Deschutes, who was a citizen of the United States and a member of the Colville tribe, crossed the colonial border and shot an elk and requested that the Canadian police come and request him. And he did it to make a point that that was his traditional use area and that he had rights there. And the court ruled in his favor that non-resident Indigenous people have rights that need to be respected within their traditional territories.
And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Guy Archibald, Executive Director, and Esther East, President of the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission, which consists of 15 Indigenous nations in Southeast Alaska and rooted along Canada's transboundary rivers. The commission recently filed a formal and urgent request with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, calling for the stop of the reckless mining activity that is violating Indigenous people's human rights throughout the region and places them at risk and all life forms for extinction.
And so there are already court cases that say we have the right to protect against mining and we have the right to have a seat at the table in this area to protect our salmon and all the contaminants that are flowing down our streams. And so, you know, if I ever get a chance to meet Mr. Deschutes, I'm sure I will be starstruck and ask for his autograph, because I just think that that is the most amazing thing, and that is the bravery and that kind of spirit are just absolutely wonderful, and they're our modern day warriors. But I just want to comment that we have other people that are working on this, like those that Guy had mentioned, and we have other partners that we're collaborating with. But precedence has already been set. There are several different cases that are in our favor, and the British Columbia the government is now wanting to change all of that so that they don't have to give us a seat at the table and they don't have to hear our voice and acknowledge our protections. Engagement with us is very different from informed consent.
Well, speaking of precedent, back in 2020, right, the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission filed an international human rights complaint against the federal government of Canada. And last fall, right, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights agreed that mining practices in BC or British Columbia may violate the fundamental human rights of Southeast Alaska tribes. And so that is precedent, another example of precedent. And I guess with this current request, what comes next? And then also, what would you like our listeners to do?
Yes, well, right now the International Commission on Human Rights is going through what they call the merit review. They're going to look at our complaint on its merits now that they've found that it was admissible and make a decision, you know, based on the facts, you know, if indeed Canada is violating our rights due to lack of consultation on these mines. In the meantime, we have also filed a request for precautionary measures because this new mine on the Unic River, the Eskay Creek mine, is going into its environmental assessment process probably before the end of the month here. And so it has the potential of being fully certified within a year and a half. And so we kind of can't wait. and so we've requested that the Inter-American Commission invoke the precautionary principle and ask that further mine authorizations in these transboundary rivers be halted until such time as they can complete their investigation and request and enact any kind of remedies that hopefully Canada will follow. You know, it's an international agreement, so Canada may or may not feel that, you know, obliged to follow it. So we followed up, you know, on that. In the meantime, we also conducted a, like Esther mentioned earlier, with Sea Alaska Heritage, a traditional use and occupation study that showed that the entire Unic watershed, including Eskay Creek, the KSM, the Bruce Jack Mine, and others, it all falls within the recognized traditional territory of the Taykwadi. There's pictographs on the river over 5,000 years old, Taykwadi clan symbols of the rising sun, and lots of testimonials and evidence. And we submitted all that. And to BC, meeting all the triggers of the Desautel court case, saying we have rights that need to be recognized and protected under the Canadian Constitution. And like Esther mentioned as well, now Canada's decided this just to move the goalposts. You know, we basically had a first down on the 1 yard line, and now they're moving the goalposts 10 yards back. And we're looking at options right now to object and maybe file a judicial review. It's basically an appeal to that decision right now. But the Desautel case, we have to be cognizant of, took 10 years to wind itself through the court system. Wow. We're in a situation here where we cannot wait 10 years while BC authorizes and builds more and more mines, because it'll be too late. So we need to put as much pressure as we can on Canada and British Columbia to follow their own laws. They ratified the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. BC has codified it into law, and they've had over 2 years since the Desautel case to figure out how to implement that Supreme Court decision. And it's just unconscionable that they'll suddenly, the first time, you know, it's tried to be used, that they'll try to change it. they'll try to change it. Desotel specifically looked at residency as a factor and rejected it. The factor for rights is the potential to be harmed by the government's actions, and the government's actions in authorizing these mines clearly has a real potential to harm our communities. And so we should be afforded deep consultation. They cannot design a mine and mitigate its impacts if they don't talk to the people downstream about what exactly those impacts may be. But that's the road they want to go down. So power never gives up power easily.
Esther, any final thoughts just regarding, you know, Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission, right, which represents 15 Southeastern Alaska Native Nations, you know, and what people can do. And so we've been talking about, you know, this kind of transboundary place, these transboundary colonial borders of Alaska in the United States and British Columbia, Canada, but also the impact, you know, the extractive mining industry continues to have on Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples, you know, particularly up in the Northwest of the United States. So as we conclude our interview here on the work that the SEITC is doing and the urgency, right, of submitting this this claim or this this request to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to stop the violent legacy of the extractive mining industry, whether it be gold or silver or other base metals. Final thoughts and what people can do.
Yeah, Larry, I'd just like to say gnaschish, which is thank you in our language for covering this story. We really appreciate you bringing light to the challenges and the fight that we're in the middle of and what we're trying to do to protect our lands and waterways. You had mentioned what can viewers do, and a couple of thoughts that just came to mind, which there obviously are long, long lists. But we need to think about our lifestyles and how what we're doing and how the way that we're living impacts the environment, and try to be cognizant of changing that footprint and walking gently on Mother Earth, which includes more recycling and less use of a lot of these resources that the mines are now moving forward as aggressively as possible, because people are wanting gold, they're wanting all of the things that come from these extractive industries that are now harming our lands and our waterways. So gnaschish to you for bringing light to this, and we really appreciate that, Larry.
The moment of silence is over.
And that was Guy Archibald, Executive Director, and Esther Reese, President of the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission. For more information on the work that they're doing, you can visit their website at www.seitc.org. They have been speaking on the organization or the commission's recent formal request to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to stop the violent colonial legacy of the mining activity that continues endangering Southeastern Alaska, Indigenous nations, and all life forms throughout the region, and more. That concludes our show for today here on American Indian Airwaves. A special thank you to our guests, Guy Archibald and Esther Reese. A special thank you to our musical guests, Aragon Star, Kupa Aina, and the band Blackfire. American Indian Airwaves is mixed and mastered in the studios of Burnt Swamp Studios in Signal Hill, California. For Marcus Lopez, I've been your host for the hour, Larry Smith. Until next time.
against our fears, try not to become what we've been told, wearing our souls on a thread. The moment of silence is over.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
The leaves are falling, the birds are chirping, and KBOO's fall membership drive is back. If you enjoy alternative radio,